Hello and welcome to Film Stalker Film Club Round 8, I think it is now. And this one is a Dennis Hopper special. It's a bit late because we've been a bit behind with the recordings, trying to match up schedules, but we're getting there. Each of us chose one Dennis Hopper film and we put that to the vote on, I think this one went on Film Stalker, didn't it, guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, the poll actually went live, so anybody could vote. And we asked for everyone to vote on which film we should review. So let's go around the choices we had. I chose Hoosiers, although is it Hoosiers? I'm not sure.
I think it's Hoosiers, isn't it?
It looks like it should be Hoosiers, but then it's an American spelling, so it could be anything. That's the Gene Hackman-led film about basketball team. I almost said baseball. Where is my head at? The basketball team, and he's a coach of a small-town basketball team. And Dennis Hopper plays, a quite unusual character to his normal characters, and I think it's one of his best performances, personally. That was my choice, which didn't make it. Mark, you chose something different as well, something unusual from his career.
Oh, yeah, I did. I can't tell you what it was, though, because I've forgotten.
I can tell you.
Oh, well, there you go.
The Osterman Weekend.
There you go. Yeah, it was. Chosen, A, because I like the title, and B, because it sounded like quite a glorious romp.
Oh, have you never seen it?
No.
Ah.
So that's why I chose it, because I thought, ooh, out of all the ones kind of, you know, that weren't the obvious choices, that one sounded the most interesting.
And again, I think that's... So none of these films he's really the lead in. That one was Rutger Hauer was the lead, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I'm quite a big fan of Rutger Hauer anyway.
Mm.
I think he's vastly underrated. And I thought that the two together would have been quite interesting.
Yeah, and that's also an adaptation of a thriller writer's book. And I can't remember who it was. It's one of the famous ones. Anyway, doesn't really matter because that wasn't chosen. It was Stephen's choice that got chosen. Stephen, what did you choose?
I chose Blue Velvet. After I saw it again, I remember watching it back in the 80s. I thought it was a good film. And when I watched it the second time round, I was disappointed I'd chose it, actually. But it's a good film to talk about.
Yeah, it's one of his iconic performances, really, isn't it? If you mention Dennis Hopper, I think most people, that'll pop up in the top two, three films to mention.
Yeah, I think of Frank Bruce. I think that's why I chose it, because when you said Dennis Hopper, I thought... I also thought Speed, and I wish I'd chose Speed.
I'm glad you didn't, actually. Although we'd probably have had fun talking about that one. I'm trying to think the other choices that would probably pop up for Dennis Hopper. There's the... Oh, you know, I'm having total blanks tonight.
Easy Rider.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the other one I was thinking of.
And Super Mario.
Yeah.
Obviously. And Waterworld.
Oh, yeah, he's in that, isn't he?
Oh, dear. He has been in some really bad films, to be fair. But can anybody think where he's played a leading role?
No. Well, I'm sure he has, but I can't think of anything that I've seen with him as a leading role. Or I can't even think, when you think of Dennis Hopper, you think of these films we mentioned, and he's supporting actor in them all. He's not necessarily a supporting actor in Blue Velvet. I think they all have similar roles, but there is no leading actor.
I think you could probably say that about Easy Rider as well, to a degree.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about Easy Rider. It is an ensemble piece, isn't it?
Yeah.
Without a doubt. And I'm just looking back through his filmography on IMDb, and you're right. There's very few things that he's been a lead in.
Which is a shame, because I think he's a great actor. And for me, Hoosiers really showed that off. I'm suspecting the Osterman Weekend did as well. And I mean, Blue Velvet does too. Don't get me wrong, but it's a very atypical Dennis Hopper character performance, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's that shocking villain done well, but kind of watching it again. And I watched it many years ago, like Stephen. I saw this in the cinema. It was the first David Lynch film I'd seen. That I actually went to see a David Lynch film, because the first one I saw the first was Dune. And at the time, I thought it was amazing. But watching it now, it was almost, you know, Dennis Hopper could have just dialed the performance in. I just didn't think his performance was brilliant, and I was really looking forward to seeing it again, so I was quite upset about that.
And actually, sorry, we haven't covered the plot. I guess we'll come to that in a second, but just thinking about that, his performance there, I think it was almost made a bit too over the top by the other things that were happening around him. There's some really bizarre things that happen in the plot, in characters around him, in the situations that make his performance seem even more off-kilter. Stephen, do you want to talk about what the plot of the film is then?
The plot?
Or did I just catch you off guard with that one?
Yeah, I thought I was going to carry on talking about Frank Booth. The plot, Jeffrey Beaumont, played by Kyle, comes back to this small town where he's from college, his father's ill in hospital, so he's come back to visit his father. And it starts off with him in hospital, seeing his dad, and on his walk back home, he comes across Anita in a field, as you do, and I can't remember how he ends up there, but with this ear, he has a chat with his neighbour, who's the daughter. Oh no, he goes and sees the policeman about this ear, and the policeman's daughter overhears this conversation. She has a chat with, I think it was Jeffrey. She says she's heard things that her dad's been talking about in a certain case, and together they go and investigate where this ear had come from, or where they think it might have come from, and that leads them to a house where we first meet Frank and his bizarre ways. And from there, it's Jeffrey sinks from this idyllic small-town world into this bizarre, twisted life led by Frank Booth. And I'm not quite sure what role Dean Stockwell's character plays, whether he's... I could never quite tell whether he was Frank's boss or... Well, there's these weird characters that become involved.
Yeah, I think actually he's just a pimp of a local prostitute house. I can't even think of the word for it.
Brothel.
That's the word. It's because I've never visited one. I have no idea.
A prostitute house.
A house of prostitutes. Ye oldie house of prosers. Yeah, so he runs that, but he just seems to be, although he doesn't show it, he seems to be intimidated by Frank. So I think he's just somebody that Frank latches onto and orders around. I don't think there's any sort of boss relationship there.
No, because I think Frank seemed to be, well, not scared is the right word, but he didn't have that holdover Ben that he had over all his cronies that seemed to win, and they seemed to be on at least a level playing field.
Mm. I think he's in awe of the character slightly, and you can see that when he starts to sing, can't you?
That's right, yeah.
Anyway, we're all over the shop, aren't we? Well, let's get back to Dennis Hopper then. Let's talk about Dennis Hopper for a bit, because we were talking about his performance there, which seems over the top. And actually, Mark, you kind of lead to a point about the film that I think we all feel, that it does seem really dated now, watching it back.
Yeah, and I've been thinking about this kind of, while I watched it, and kind of, well, you two have been talking there, and I think maybe the time that I saw it originally, I'd not seen anything like that before. So that was kind of a reasonably new genre of cinema to me. But now, stuff like that is almost kind of, you know, a dime a dozen.
Mm.
And I think that's why it was less shocking now than it was then. And his performance, you know, it was an okay performance, but it just didn't have that shock factor. And even when he's, you know, got the mask on and he's breathing in the amyl nitrate and all that stuff, it was like, yeah, okay, I kind of get that, but you can see worse on a 15-cert movie now. And I think that's what led to me thinking it just lost a bit of its impact.
Yeah, it feels to me like it's a film for 15-year-olds, in a way. I mean, he swears a lot. Every second word is an F-word.
It's one of these films that you can see if it was released now, people would complain that the studio have just made it, sanitised it for PG-13. And where the hell's the proper rape scene and the wife beaten and the death and the blood and the gore? You know, where... You can kind of see that sort of argument coming out about it if it was made now.
Yeah, bizarrely, people still talk about it now as a masterpiece. I was reading an article of Mark Kermode where back in the 80s he'd slated this film. And must have been an interview with The Independent when, after Jonathan Ross left film insert year,
yeah,
he was up as one of the possible choices. And in this interview he'd said how he didn't like... Blue Velvet at the time. Yeah, no, he thinks it's a masterpiece. And I'm thinking, why is it a masterpiece? And you look all over the web, it's all masterpiece, great, best performance. And I never got all that. It's a good film, but I never got all this masterpiece stuff and fantastic performance. I just didn't get it.
But if you hadn't rewatched it and somebody had said to you, do you think it's a masterpiece, what would your answer have been?
I don't know if I said masterpiece, but yeah, I'd have said it was a better film than I now think it is.
I think I'd be influenced by it, what everyone else has been saying about it. And I think I'd rank it high up in those films and the performances because everyone keeps shouting it's a masterpiece. If I'd left it to that viewing way back then. Because I remember it did have a big impact on me, but I think it was the portrayal of the sexuality more than anything. I don't think Frank's character really freaked me out that much.
No, I think it was the swearing. I mean, every other word. I mean, you didn't hear a lot of swearing back then. I mean, they didn't. In the 80s, you still got your video nasty stuff. There weren't a lot of, there weren't a lot of F words. And yet that was littered with swearing.
It was. I think that there's a fact out, or a trivia out there, that he swears in every sentence he utters.
And he's not on screen for a great deal of time. I mean, I can only think of three big scenes where he's in. There's the first scene where we see him from Jeffrey Beaumont's voyeuristic view through the cupboard doors. There's the scene where he catches Jeffrey, and then they have that drive to Dean Stockwell, Ben's place. And there's the scene there with Ben and afterward, but I can't think of when he was on a great deal. Yeah, thinking back, I'd have thought, oh, yes, this film where he's in all the time, and he wasn't in as much as I remember.
Yeah, he is in disguise, remember, at one point, with a silly wig and moustache.
But even those, I mean, I don't think he speaks in those.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. It's another supporting role, and it's quite a lesser supporting role than some of the other ones he's had. So it's interesting that he is remembered so much for this film, or this film is remembered so much for him.
Yeah, I think this was the scariest character in film history, and people are watching scary films if that's what they think's the scariest film character.
Yeah, but I think it's scary for the, you know, not the horror thing, but the fact he's got no moral compass. And I think, if memory serves, I can't remember where I read it, but was this not the film that put him back on the map after quite a number of years in the wilderness due to his kind of hell-raising and unreliability and stuff?
Yeah, I think so.
I think it was, yeah. Because there were a lot of other people in the running for the role, apparently. And I think the story goes that something, he managed to get to talk to Lynch, and he said something about Frank is me, I am Frank, you know, I've got to play this role. And that's what captured Lynch's imagination enough to see him and then take him on.
Because Lynch had offered it to Stephen Burkoff, hadn't he?
Yeah, I think that was his original choice, I find really interesting. That would have been a good choice.
Yeah.
Now, you're talking about having a much more measured performance. That would be something you get from Stephen Burkoff.
And I think that would make it a lot more, even more sinister than it is.
Yeah.
You know, because that's the one thing I kind of did get watching it, is the fact that this guy's got no morals at all. And I think when I saw that, because it came out in 86, 87, didn't it? So I would have been 16, 17 when it came out. And kind of watching this film then, I'd probably never seen a character like that. But now, as I said before, I have done.
Now, it's like he's totally over the edge. So if he appears in the, if you were to meet that character, you know everything's just going to go.
Well, yeah, that expectation's there, isn't it? So.
Yeah. And whereas if you saw a character that perhaps Stephen Burkoff would play, a more psychological character, more you don't know which way he's going to go. Actually, kind of the feeling I get from the character that Dean Stockwell plays, there's no intrinsic threat, but you just see them and think, this is really wrong. There's something really wrong here. And you feel uneasy about it, you don't know what's going to happen. You know, that's probably what you get from Stephen Burkoff's character. And that's the kind of character that scares me more than the straight over the edge.
Yeah, I'd agree. And I think the telling thing there is that when Hopper and Stockwell shared screen time, I was more drawn to watching Dean Stockwell's performance than I was Dennis Hopper's.
Yeah, that character totally unnerved me way more than Frank. Frank just, you know, he's just going to beat the living crap out of you. But Dean Stockwell was just... He didn't need to do anything, and I would have been scared for so many reasons.
Yeah.
There's another thing, actually. So when I watched it back then compared to now, watching it then, I didn't get half of what I did from the film this time. And that's going to obviously be an age thing. But what I caught were things like the dualism between Frank and Jeffrey character, and the fact that, which I didn't catch the first time round, the fact that Jeffrey's actually really drawn to Frank and his way of life, and there's a lot of what Frank is inside Jeffrey.
All right, I didn't get that.
Well, it's the whole bit of instigating violence in the woman, and Isabella Rossellini's character.
Yeah, but I don't think Jeff... I mean, he hits her once, and when he does, he's disappointed. I mean, he doesn't...
Yeah, because
pleasure from it.
He actually carries out the act, and he suddenly realizes what's going on. But the whole way through the film, he's drawn to the darkness. He's drawn to the darkness of events going on when he should be going to the police and revealing things. He's not. He wants to. He's stalking the woman. He's hiding in her closet. He's engaging in illicit sex with her when he knows what's going on in the background, and there's a psycho there as well. You know, I got that feeling there from those two characters, and I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think he was investigating. I think he was just wanting to be this sleuth.
I don't know. I think you definitely see a change of character in him, and he definitely gets darker throughout the film. But he redeems himself later on. It's sort of the shock of when things go too far just pulls him right back. That's definitely something I got from the characters anyway.
Yeah, but he's a young guy, isn't it? It is the comparison between him and his relationship with Laura Dern, who's Sandy Williams, isn't it? And also his relationship with the Isabella Rossellini character. And it's kind of two sides of the same coin, I thought, one dark, one light. Mm. And rather than, I can't even say his bloody surname, Kyle MacLachlan, is it? And the Hopper relationship, I thought it was kind of him and the Jeffrey Beaumont character playing off on the relationship that he has with Dorothy Valens and Sandy Williams. That's how I saw it. And I thought, I didn't think he kind of changed throughout the film, but there was that duplicity there that you mentioned.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't get half those subtleties when I first watched it. I mean, obviously, because I was interested in the sex. And I wasn't that intelligent. There's also
there's the whole good and evil. I mean, we start out in this idyllic world where wicker fences and people watering the gardens, this whole perfect utopian-like society where everything's perfect. And he comes back home to this. And then hidden from all these people is this dark, violent world that he gets drawn into. But the ending is just like the beginning, as he defeats evil, sort of, and he's, as Matt said, good and evil. As he defeats evil, we're then left, he's back in this perfect white wicker fence world. He's sat in the garden, there's birds on the windowsill. He's with the girl, Rossellini's character. She's got her son back. I think we should probably explain how it. Frank is evil because he's kidnapped. What is her character's name, Isabella Rossellini's?
Everyone click, go fast. Dorothy Valens.
Dorothy Valens, that's it. He's kidnapped her husband and son. And at the end, she's reunited with his son. Her husband dies in a bizarre, macabre ending to the evil part. And good has triumphed over evil again.
Do you think it has actually triumphed, or is the fact that what the film's showing is there's this perfect veneer of what life should be like, idyllic life that everyone wants to see, but actually the darkness and the underbelly is always there. It's just that people choose not to see it and live the life a certain way.
Yeah, there's definitely that as well. Yeah. I think if Lynch was going for this darkness hidden and people choose to ignore, because that's why I always thought it would have been better had Frank been an upstanding pillar of the community and people didn't realise he was this evil character. But no, I still think good triumphed because we ended up all... Yeah, because she's back with the daughter. He's dead. He's got his girl. And Mark, well, what was the bird at the end? Now I can't remember, but that was mentioned at the beginning. And then the bird appears at the end as well.
The great animatronics bird.
Yeah.
What bird?
There was a bird on the windowsill.
God, there is, isn't there? Yeah, because at the end it's got a beetle in its mouth.
Yeah.
I can't remember. No, I know nothing about birds. Well, the feathered kind.
We're going to start talking about Katie Sackhoff.
Ah, here we go. Well, somebody said this, obviously. The robin, as mentioned earlier by Sandy, recounting her dream, represents love conquering evil.
And were the beetles crawling over all over the ear to start with or something?
I don't know about that. And it weren't beetles anyway.
There were beetles at the start, weren't there?
Yeah.
You didn't see them, but I can't remember in what context.
I don't remember the beetles.
We could be, do you know what? I did a few good numbers, actually, in the past.
I was just about to crack that joke.
Dear me.
The Beatles, the birds. Was it not just a film about 60s bands?
Very good.
Was there not a Rolling Stone somewhere?
Moving on from that, because I'm just thinking we could probably read loads of things into this that probably aren't there. Because I always started thinking about how the birds represent the good and the beetles were the evil and they were devouring the ER and they were, and it's probably never meant like that at all. We're just reading too much into it.
I mean, maybe, but there is a load of stuff missing from it, isn't there? Because when he first cut it, he wanted to release it as a 4-hour version.
Yeah, I read that as well, yeah.
So it makes me wonder if he kind of chopped it down to the extent where he expects people to jump to conclusions and interpret it how they see fit. I don't know. But, I'd like to see that 4-hour version just to see how it stacks up.
Apparently, though, it doesn't exist. They can't find the 2 hours. They've never been able to find it anywhere. The only stills exist from the 2 hours.
Right.
Apparently, they're on the special edition DVD. That's I didn't watch it that way. I watched it on a crappy quality iTunes download. Apparently, if you get the special edition DVD, you'll see some photos from those missing 2 hours, but nobody's been able to find them.
Right. That's a shame, isn't it?
It is a shame, because it'd be interesting to see the full 4 hours, although I suspect it'd be a rambling mess. I'm not really a big Lynch fan, although I do remember this film particularly caught my eye. And it's interesting, actually, talking about Lynch and some of his work, is that there's a lot of comparative moments between this and Twin Peaks. One, something that really caught my eye the most was the relationship between Jeffrey and Frank, and the idea of the relationship between the I can't remember the FBI agent's name that Kyle MacLachlan plays in Twin Peaks, but between him and Bob. It just sparked things off when I was watching Blue Velvet. It just sparked things off in my head about that relationship between the two characters. I'm guessing by the stony silence, everyone's probably sitting looking at the computers going, what the hell is he talking about? I didn't get that.
I've never seen Twin Peaks.
I've seen Twin Peaks.
Oh, well. You should do. It's very good. Anyway, there we go. I can't talk about that. Anyway, I thought there were a lot of similarities between that. Anyway, as I was watching Blue Velvet, I was thinking of that very, very strongly. Came to the fore. Something else about the time gap between the two films. So it's interesting that we all watched it then, and there's been a long gap before we watched it again. And especially for being such a well-known film. I find that quite surprising. We've talked about how the film looks dated, and ourselves watching it now and then, what our different thoughts were. But I think it was you, Mark, was going to talk about the actors, the difference in the actors.
I watched it, and the performances that I was expecting to watch weren't the ones that I ended up watching. Basically, I'll be watching, the Dennis Hopper performance and the Kyle MacLachlan performance. And it wasn't those two that I kind of was most excited about. It was the Dean Stockwell piece, which I thought was amazing. And also the Brad Dourif bit, and he's only in it as a real background character. But I thought he was great. And I really couldn't put my finger on it until it had finished, and I was kind of thinking about how Kyle MacLachlan played that character. And essentially, he always plays himself to the extent where if he took his character from Showgirls and put it in Blue Velvet and swapped the two around, you'd probably end up with exactly the same thing on screen. I thought the Jeffrey Bowman character was quite good, but I'd have loved to have seen it in somebody else's hands. And I just couldn't decide why that was the case. And it must be down to him. But the one performance that I did like was the Laura Dern performance. I thought she was great. And I thought that for me, she kind of actually almost brought the film together and kind of made it worth watching. So she was, she really gelled it for me. I thought the Isabella Rossellini performance was okay. But it just didn't set me on fire. I just couldn't understand why when I was watching it.
Yeah, I think she was a bit too, I can't think of the word, maybe like scatterbrain or kind of all over the place, really. Again, maybe it was that she was going a little too much to extremes, like the Frank character did for me.
Yeah, maybe. There was almost no reaction to her sometimes, especially when Frank was being pretty merciless with her. It was just, just accept it and get on with it. And whether that's because he had her kid or not, I just don't know when that was the idea behind it.
There was no real connection to her, was there? Yeah, as the audience member, I didn't feel any real connection. I was watching things as Jeffrey was watching it through the cupboard door, actually, kind of that way.
Mm.
I just didn't, you're right. Looking back on it, I didn't feel much for her.
No, and the only good performance, I think, that the pair had put in was when she knows he's in the cupboard and she brings him out. And, the kind of implied sexiness that's there. And then kind of he dives back in when Frank rocks up. I thought that for me was the best performance that both of them gave.
There are some actually very powerful, sexually powerful scenes between the two of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
You really do feel on screen. That's something very clever about the film. But it's interesting. I was just looking at the careers there of Laura Dern and Kyle MacLachlan, and Laura Dern, I forget the film before Blue Velvet, I've never heard of, but the film before that was Mask. And now I remember her for Mask, and I think she was really good in that as well. I seem to remember. It's a long time ago.
She's brilliant in that.
And Kyle MacLachlan had only done one other film before then, and it was June.
Really?
But he only had to look mean and moody.
Yeah. Because he was one of the Atreides clan, wasn't he?
Paul Atreides, yeah.
Yeah.
Let me just make sure I read that right. Yeah, yeah, that was his... So June was 1984 and Blue Velvet was 1986. With The Hidden in 1987. Oh, that's a good film.
Yeah, classic in the class there.
Yeah, I didn't... Some of the lines, actually, for the characters were atrociously bad. I'm not going to remember specifics. I just remember watching it and going, oh, dear, at some of the lines they were coming out with, especially Kyle MacLachlan's character. But I didn't...
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't believe him at all. I didn't feel anything for Rossellini's character. I just felt like I was watching a character on screen. Yeah, and the more I think about it, you're right about Laura Dern. She was the one that held it together. You got anything on that, Stephen? You feel anything particularly about that?
No, I didn't think Rosalina acted very well. Certainly wasn't drawn to her or anything.
Can I say something here? And this isn't to do with the film.
Go on.
This doesn't seem to be working tonight as well as it normally does.
No.
Do you think it's because the film was... I can't believe that I'm going to say this. I really can't. But I get the feeling that if we'd sat down and watched Speed, we would have had a far, far better conflap than this.
I think you're right. And I think we started talking about it quite early on, and that none of us are agreeing that Blue Velvet should be called a masterpiece. I think that's fair to say. I think it's fair to say, let me speak for all of you, you can shoot me down in flames if I'm wrong, but I think it's far from a masterpiece, and there's a huge amount of overhype about it. The second viewing had some nice moments, but it's very dated and it's really disappointing. It's got some embarrassingly bad lines, underdeveloped characters. You don't feel anything for some of the characters. There's just no connection with it, and it kind of runs its distance, and you've watched it.
Yeah. I think the trouble is as well, we've watched either really good films or we've watched really bad films, like the Space Vampire thing. But we've always had something to talk about. All three of us think, well, we thought it was great. We realised it's not. We can't understand why people go on about it so much. It was just an okay film.
Yeah, I'd agree. It was so middle of the road. It was an okay film. That was it. It's not brilliant, but it's not totally It's just okay. And if he wants to, when he re-releases it, he can put that on the tagline. I don't mind.
I'm sure he will. I'm sure that would be one of the first ones to put in. You know, actually, I saw June a little while ago, and compared to June, this makes June look like a masterpiece. I would rate June way higher than Blue Velvet, and I know that's going to make David Lynch fans and film fans just go mental. Yeah, I got more excited at June than I did for Blue Velvet.
I tend to agree, because I watched it a couple of years ago. And apart from kind of stinging his underpants, I quite enjoyed it. I mean, it's bloody long and hard work in places, but apart from that, there's some good stuff going on in there.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm just looking at Lynch's career, because I'm not a huge fan of Lynch. I think it's just so head up his own arse sometimes, to be honest. Being weird just for the sake of being weird, because his name's Lynch. And there's not much in his career that I get excited about. Twin Peaks... But you know what? I wonder if I watched that now, I'd have a similar feeling to Blue Velvet.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched a few of his films, and the two that I kind of really, really like are Wild at Heart and the Straight Story.
Oh, I've never seen that.
About the dude on the lawnmower.
Oh, yes, yes. I know what you mean, but I've never watched it.
That is fantastic. But he's not trying to be clever. He's not trying to be sinister. He's just making a really good film. And it works.
Did he not write that one? He didn't write
it. He didn't write it. No, he came. I think he came. I don't know what was behind it, but he came on, didn't he? As just a kind of director for hire, I believe.
Well, there we go. I think we've just ostracised ourselves from the film community there by saying that Lynch isn't all he's hyped up to be, and Blue Velvet isn't really that good.
Mm. But there is one other Lynch film, which I've forgotten about, which is amazing. And in fact, it's probably, you know, in one of my top 50 films, and that's The Elephant Man.
Oh, yes. And that's not so weird, as it's not got that Lynchian weirdness in it.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a good film.
Yeah.
You know, he's not trying to outweird himself. He's not trying to be a little bit kinky. It's just a great film.
It's like when Cronenberg decided to drop... I feel a similar way about Cronenberg's older films, which some of them are really good, but, you know, there came a point where he thought, you know, let me stop doing the Cronenberg thing and let me just make a film.
Yeah.
And we came out, we've seen some great films from him, and we continue to see some amazing films from him, some of the best of his career. It would be nice if Lynch did that as well, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
I did think I love Mulholland Drive, but then I've not seen that recently either. And I don't think it's just because of the girl on girl either. But you never...
Do you know what? I've been meaning to watch that film for ages, and I think I might get around to it this weekend.
Girl on Girl.
What, that film? Actually, do you know what? I started watching it, and when the rabbits came on, the stupid soundtrack and the stage performance thing at the start, I was like, you know what? I can't be bothered sitting through this rubbish to just see the girl on girl action. I mean, to see what the film's all about.
I really enjoyed Mulholland Drive, but yeah, I mean, that's probably not as good again as I think it is.
Mm. Well, I think it's safe to say that was quite a disappointing show for Dennis Hopper.
I mean, one thing before we finish, I mean, the title track was inspired for him to pick Blue Velvet.
Inspired because it matched the title of the film.
Well, the title song would match the song, but because, I mean, it just didn't give it that weird edge. But apart from that,
I thought there were some. Some good choices in the soundtrack, to be honest. Did like that.
Yeah, I thought the soundtrack was pretty spectacular.
And there were some great orchestrated pieces that. I'm trying to remember exactly where I heard these because it's been a little while since I saw the film now. But I think, for instance, when he's walking in his way home through the grass, there's an orchestrated piece that just puts you on edge, that knocks you off kilter without anything in the images doing it. And that comes on a few times, and I really like that. And there's so often the soundtrack is at odds with what you're watching, but it's like just perfectly aligned. It's hard to describe, but it works.
Mm-hmm. One great film, on average a pretty poor director, great soundtrack, and the odd good bit. Are we not talking about Tarantino all of a sudden?
Oh, I like Tarantino.
I like him less with each film, although I've not seen Inglourious Basterds yet, so...
Yeah.
At the moment, I will watch that this week.
It's all right.
I enjoyed it, I must say. But it's not his best film. His best film, obviously, is From Dusk Till Dawn.
Oh, no. Yes. See, I would say...
Some of his films, wasn't it? Was that not Rodriguez as well?
Yeah, it was Rodriguez.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
So his best film is Pulp Fiction, probably. Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs are both really good films.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I like Kill Bill's.
Well, Kill Bill's quite cool, but it's not really a story. It's more... It's this sort of loose thread story to pull together some cool scenes.
Yeah.
Which is cool. It worked. It's really nice to watch, but, you know, I'm not drawn to the story that much.
Grindhouse, his film was the lesser of the two as well. Rodriguez was the better film of them.
Yeah.
Well, I really liked... And this is because I've got a soft spot for Kurt Russell as a bad guy. But I quite liked Death Proof. I thought it was quite cool.
Good-looking women.
Fast cars. Kurt Russell as a baddie. Some pretty cool car scenes. I quite liked it.
No, I mean, I enjoyed it. I would watch it again if it was on the telly. I just don't think it was a good film. And I think the second one... What was it called now? Rodriguez's film. Death Proof and...
Planet Terror.
That's it.
Do you know what? It's interesting. So, Stephen, when you flipped off there, that's the wrong phrase. when you cut out of Skype there, I was talking about David Cronenberg's career and how I felt that, you know, his films are good, but, you know, he was trying to be too odd sometimes and trying to be too Cronenberg, which I think Lynch does. He just tries to be too weird, too Lynch, because there's this whole persona now, what a Lynch film is, and I think he goes down that road a bit too much. And I felt that's what Cronenberg was doing. And when he dropped that and decided to make just a straight film, we've been getting some amazing films from Cronenberg, and I wish that Lynch would do that. And that's almost, I think, he could chart that same sort of feeling for Tarantino. He's doing Tarantino again and again, and he's going too far down that route. And I'm wondering if he could just drop that idea and make a good film. Just make a film. We'd see something really special again from him.
Yeah, I don't know if Tarantino could stop doing Tarantino, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you look back at Reservoir Dogs, and we've gone totally off base, but it doesn't matter. You look back at Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction is a great film.
It is, but it's very Tarantino, isn't it, as well?
And it ties into Lynch with the ear as well.
Ah, well. So we've gone totally off base, but that's maybe an interesting topic for another day. I think it's fair to say we've chosen a really bad film for the Dennis Hopper special. Although, actually, we didn't choose it. People who voted on the site chose it. None of us liked it, and it's definitely not the best of his career.
No. I have to say, I've been thinking about this while you two have been talking. The most unsettling part of the film, for me, was the first few minutes and the last 5 minutes when they're meant to return to normality. I thought that was the most sinister part, and maybe it's meant to be that way.
Yeah, and I think that's why I was saying earlier, or suggesting earlier, I don't think it gets defeated, because that ending for me didn't make me feel, everything's all sunshine and light again, I feel great.
Mm.
Although the characters we'd watch and are dealt with or their story arcs are completed in a nice way, that final scene didn't feel right at all.
Yeah.
Stephen, what do you think about them, just to sum up?
They did have that eerie feel to them, that beginning and end, even though it was good. It reminded me, you know, when you see Edward Scissorhands and it all looks perfect, and yet underneath it's not. It had that feel to it. But maybe that's what he was saying.
Yeah, maybe.
And just like the film, it looks good, but underneath it's pretty cack.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think it's fair to say we've destroyed Blue Velvet. And so...
Somebody needed to. There's been too much masterpiece talk going around.
Yes, actually, there has. The more, when I was looking at it and doing some little research before this, I was quite surprised at how highly it was thought of, or is thought of. And actually, if I'd looked that up and seen all those quotes I was looking at and seen everyone's reviews before the second viewing, or this current viewing, I'd have probably agreed with them. I think I was being influenced by what everyone else said.
Yeah, before I saw it the second time round, I don't think I thought it was a masterpiece, but I thought it was good, but I thought it reminded me of the Coen Brothers film with the bowling. What's it called? Coen Brothers bowling. The Big Lebowski.
That's it.
And I haven't got to it either. The Big Lebowski is a great film. Yeah, the dude character and the whole thing is so overhyped with all these festivals they have and everything. And at the time, I thought, when I started watching this, it reminded me of a similar thing of people who've got this character of Frank on a pedestal, like the dude. But at least the Big Lebowski is worth watching a few times. I want to watch the Blue Velvet again.
It'd be interesting to go back to the Big Lebowski in 10, 15 years.
Yeah, I don't think I'd be disappointed with it. Whereas... Well,
not as much as you were with Blue Velvet.
No.
All right, well, I think that's safe to say that's Film Stalker, Film Club Round 8, done and dusted. So all it leaves me to say is goodbye from me and goodbye from Mark.
Cheerio. It's been a pleasure as always.
Quick plug for your site again.
Yeah, I'm www.markbuckleyphotography.co.uk, catering for all your photography needs.
All of them?
No, that's a lie.
All right.
About 5% of them.
Okay, well, my nude photo shot is out then. Never mind. And Stephen, thank you very much again.
Welcome.
You don't have anything to promote. All right, well, everyone, thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you again in the next one. Cheers.
Beneath the surface of the perfect small town, a dark world awaits.
Are you the one that found the ear?
You know anything?
Well, one name that keeps coming up is this woman's singer.
I'll bet someone could learn a lot by getting into that woman's apartment.
I don't know if you're a detective or a pervert.
Well, it's for me to know and you to find out.
What are you doing in my apartment? I close my eyes.
Then I drift away.
Hey!
Who is this?
And not an ear of corn.
No, an ear with an E. That was like the silence there. Just on a roll.
Where's Stephen gone?
I think Stephen's got nothing to say. Stephen?
He's not there, is he? He's dropped out of the call.
He's got so uninterested. He's just going, oh, I hate this Blue Velvet crap.
Yeah.
When did you drop out?
About 5 minutes ago.
Oh, yes, you're just taking a sabbatical.
World Cup's out of the way.
No, there's another week of the Tour de France, and then I'll be in the job sector. Bizarre.